If she grew up, she could do it too. Jane made her want to stand up straight and stop referring to herself as a girl. When Jane's fingers reached the orange, their hands touched. Zoe smiled. Chapter 39. Harry had been looking forward to the SAT class all week. His mother had been taking his phone whenever he was home, which was like living in pioneer days, but only during mealtimes and when he was playing video games on the Roku in the living room. Elizabeth didn't quite seem to understand that his computer did everything his phone did except make phone calls, and who wanted to talk on the phone anyway. He'd been playing by their rules, though, and hadn't been in touch with Ruby since leaving the police station. It all felt very Romeo and Juliet, minus the suicide. Still, he understood. If they'd gotten caught having sex in his bedroom, it would have been one thing, but in public, the police station, that was worth some punishment. His parents had never been strict or unreasonable. His father, in particular, had always been willing to sit down and have lengthy conversations about why Harry had to wait until Hanukkah for a new Thomas the Tank engine train or whatever. This seemed fair. Iggy Pop had been gone a week. They'd put posters up all over the neighborhood, at bus stops and on telephone poles, plus on cork boards at the three different coffee shops on Cortelyou. Iggy had never been gone longer than a day before, and Harry was starting to imagine the more bleak possibilities. He told his friend Arpad about both the cat and having sex with Ruby in one phone call, and Arpad had only asked about the cat, assuming the latter was a joke. Harry wasn't sure what the bigger joke was, that he'd gotten to lose his virginity to the girl of his dreams, or that he was never, ever going to have sex ever again, at least not with Ruby. There were no other prospects. There had been other girls at Whitman whom Harry had stared at across the library, but now that he'd touched Ruby's body, now that he knew what was possible in the universe, he wasn't going to settle for just anybody. His parents had been clear. He was in trouble for the first time in his entire life, and his punishment was not being allowed to sit next to Ruby, or to speak to her unless absolutely necessary. But they also weren't going to be there. Harry was jittery on the walk to the karate studio. He was running through all the different ways he could say hello. He could saunter in and pretend not to notice her, but sit right next to her as usual and then pass a note. He could kiss her right on the mouth in front of the Queen Dork and Eliza and Thayer and everybody. He could wait to see if she said anything to him first. Maybe she was secretly glad to be rid of him. After all, nobody wanted to have to teach her boyfriend how to have sex. Not that he was her boyfriend. Was he her boyfriend? Or rather, had he been? Harry wanted a neon sign in the sky, anything that would tell him what to do. Ruby wasn't there yet, of course not. That was good. That meant that where she sat was up to her. Harry took his regular seat in the last row and pulled his notebook out of his backpack. In a funny way, having Ruby in the class had made him significantly less stressed out about taking the SATs. He did take notes, at least as often as he and Ruby passed notes back and forth. And he did feel like he had learned a few things. College was the light at the end of the tunnel, and Harry wanted that light so badly. He thought he probably wanted to go somewhere small, but not small. Amherst, maybe, or Wesleyan. But fuck, maybe he wanted to go to Deep Springs, or whatever it was called, and learn how to be a farmer and a gentleman poet. He swiveled around in his chair every time he heard the door open. Everyone else seemed to have made friends with one another. Harry hadn't noticed. The rest of the class could have been taught in Chinese and he wouldn't have noticed. Rebecca opened her computer and projected an image of a geometry problem. An isosceles triangle, the easy kind. Harry tuned out as she started to talk. He knew enough to get by. Class had started. Ruby was late. He smelled her shampoo before he saw her. Rebecca turned the lights off to make the screen easier to see, and then Ruby slipped into the chair next to him, giving him the quickest, blink-and-you-missed-it kiss on the cheek. Harry turned toward her, smiling with all his teeth. Ruby reached over and into his mouth and gave his tongue a soft pinch. She loudly let her bag drop and rifled through it, like a dog digging for a bone.
"Is your bag just full of random loose-leaf paper?"
Harry asked.
"Shh," Ruby said. "Yes."
She found what she was looking for and slapped it on Harry's desk. It was her mother's schedules for the next 2 weeks, printed off their joint calendar.
"Dr. Amelia," she said. "That's their sex doctor. And now she's our sex doctor, too, if you know what I'm saying. Her office is in Park Slope, which means we have at least 2 hours from the minute they walk out the door. And that's a meeting with their purveyor in Jersey, which means they'll be gone for like 5 hours, sniffing tomato plants or whatever. She pointed at the name. It was still 6 days away, but there it was, their next date. Harry felt his whole body relax. Maybe he'd just go to Brooklyn College. How could he leave? He could rent an apartment, and Ruby could live with him and just hide in the closet when his parents came over. He'd say that he had some other girlfriend, someone who traveled a lot, a Rhodes Scholar. He was dating a Rhodes Scholar who was in Barcelona for the year, and so he was holding on to her stuff, which is why there were two toothbrushes in the bathroom and purses hanging off the doorknobs. Maybe they would be over it by then, and understand that Ruby wasn't some bad girl in the first place, but the best girl, the only girl. It was all going to be fine. It was all going to be perfect. "I love you," Harry said, louder than he meant to. A kid with a stupid haircut in the row in front of them snickered, and Harry kicked the back of his chair.
"I mean it, Ruby. I love you."
"I know you do," Ruby said. She reached over and pinched him on the arm, and that was enough for now. Chapter 40 Elizabeth was genuinely worried that Iggy Pop was dead. Either dead or adopted by some stupid kid in the neighborhood who couldn't read and or look at signs on telephone poles. It happened a lot. Someone puts out a bowl of cream and the cat thinks it's discovered a higher plane of existence. At least a few times a day, Elizabeth would see something out of the corner of her eye and she would think, "Oh, thank God, Iggy's right there." But then it was always a dust ball or a wadded-up T-shirt. When she walked to and from the office and to her listings in the neighborhood, she kept peering down driveways and onto front porches, even more than she usually did. Deirdre thought cats were disgusting pets and had very little sympathy. "They're wild," she said in between forkfuls of salad at their desk. "Cats were never meant to live with humans. I've heard about people who were killed, murdered by their cats. That's why we only have fish." Deirdre plucked a walnut out of the salad with her fingers. "This place is so stingy. There are 4 walnuts in this entire salad."
"Iggy Pop isn't going to murder me," Elizabeth said. "The worst he does is when he walks across your face in the middle of the night. But I'm usually awake anyway."
"See, if I had a cat, and it walked across my face in the middle of the night, I would take that as a warning sign. I think your cat isn't missing. He's out there gathering enough sticks and bones to build an army, I'm telling you."
"I appreciate your concern." Elizabeth leaned back in her chair. There was a lot to be done. She had to draw up contract information for the house on East 19th. And for an apartment on Newkirk. She had to get another big house on Ditmas Avenue ready for its first open house. And the dining room still looked like an episode of Hoarders, Beanie Baby Special Edition.
"I think right now I'd welcome his tiny army, though. I just want him to come back."
Deirdre reached over and gave Elizabeth's knee a quick pat.
"I know, sweetheart. We'll find that mangy little killer."
The office phone rang, and Deirdre spun around to answer it. Elizabeth rubbed her temples with her fingers.
"It's for you, I think," Deirdre said.
She had a funny look on her face, which meant only one thing. Elizabeth picked up her extension. "Hello," she said. "Still holding for Naomi Vandenhoevel," someone said.
"Right," said Elizabeth.
"What the hell?"
Deirdre mouthed.
"Trust me, I barely understand it myself," Elizabeth said.
"Hello from Ohio,"
rang out Naomi's voice.
"Are you actually filming at Oberlin?"
Elizabeth couldn't picture Naomi in Ohio. Not even Cleveland. Not even the Ritz-Carlton Cleveland, where Andrew's parents had stayed for graduation, despite the fact that it was a solid hour's drive from school. She hadn't realized that things were going to happen so fast. She'd sort of forgotten about it on purpose, since signing their names, assuming that it would be ages before she'd have to tell Andrew. Maybe by then he'd have come around? It wasn't a great plan, but it was all she had. Naomi laughed.
"No, no, of course not. We're in Pasadena. But you should see it. We're shooting so muddy. It's very 1990.
"That's great," Elizabeth said, though she was feeling flustered. She was still in the office, after all, and couldn't suddenly have a freak out with Deirdre and the rest of the O'Connells bearing witness.
"What can I do for you?"
"All business. I like it. Hang on," she said,
and then Elizabeth listened while Naomi ordered a coffee with almond milk and 3 extra shots of espresso.
"I was watching you and Lydia write this song, and so I wanted to call you.
You look great. Very skinny. Really great hair.
Kind of a big mouth. Not like Steven Tyler big, but maybe Liv Tyler big. Actually, you know, you look a lot like a blonde Liv Tyler."
Young you, I mean. Elizabeth quickly moved her free hand to her head.
Oh, God, she said.
Don't even worry about it. You look amazing. Just wanted to give you an update. The girls are so cute together. They're like all over each other's Instagrams already. You should check it out.
I will, Elizabeth said. She thought for a moment about herself and Lydia. Lydia, who had never liked her. It wasn't like with Zoe, who was clearly in a class above in terms of sophistication, but somehow found Elizabeth amusing anyway. Lydia had practically turned her back when Elizabeth entered a room, like a haughty cat or a sullen teenager. Which she had been, of course.
Wait, Naomi?
Her stomach sank.
Mm-hmm.
It's so funny that I haven't thought to ask this before. What's the time frame of the movie? I assumed it was mostly Lydia at the peak or, you know, up until the end. There isn't a lot of college stuff in there, is there?
In her mind, her part of the story was a sliver at the beginning, before Lydia became Lydia and the movie really began. She'd wanted to see them all larger than life, which is how everything felt right at that moment anyway. But Elizabeth had assumed that the movie would have briskly moved on to the more glamorous stuff. But now she was faced with the sudden terrifying thought that she had no input whatsoever about how their shared youth was going to be portrayed, and that Andrew was not going to be happy, not one bit, no matter how she tried to spin her misguided hope. She had wanted it for him as much as for herself. Elizabeth knew how much Andrew had loved the band, and Lydia, and her. Yes, that was part of it, too. Elizabeth wanted Andrew to see the movie and to remember how much he had loved her once upon a time, when they were still kids and life was an endless, open ocean, stretching out at once in all directions.
You know, I can't really talk right now, Naomi said, but do you want to see the script? I'll have my assistant send it over, okay?
So is that a yes or a no?
Yes, totally.
Yes, there isn't a lot of college stuff, or yes, there is. And you know that Lydia did not write the song, like, at all, right?
Elizabeth's neck polka-dotted with big red blotches.
Hello?
But Naomi had hung up. Elizabeth removed the finger from her ear and handed the phone back to Deirdre to hang up. Deirdre was staring at her, her eyebrows so high they looked like part of her hairline.
I'm ready when you are, Deirdre said.
She crossed her arms expectantly.
Elizabeth had meant to tell Andrew about the movie, about signing his name. She thought about calling Zoe to practice on her, but she was too ashamed of herself. Elizabeth was always waiting for something, and then, after Harry got in trouble with Ruby, it just felt as if things were too tight, too stressed. Andrew wasn't good at managing balls in the air unless they were all made of helium. Good news could pile on all day, but if the news was bad, it was best to measure it out slowly, like antibiotics.
It's a very long story, Elizabeth said. But this is good. I'll use you as practice.
Deirdre unwrapped a stick of gum, as excited as if Elizabeth had just agreed to do a striptease. Chapter 41 Andrew was sitting on the porch when Elizabeth got home. It was hot outside, inching toward the part of the summer when Brooklyn was thick and airless. They had air conditioners in the bedrooms and one in the dining room, but they didn't do much, especially on the first floor, where the rooms were large and open. The dark stone porch was often the coolest place in the house.
I took the fans out of the basement, Andrew said. I put one in the living room and two upstairs.
Thanks, Elizabeth said. Can I talk to you about something?
She wasn't good at this part, even after so many years of marriage. It was her parents' fault, of course. She had never once seen them have an argument. It just wasn't in their nature. And so Elizabeth had spent her entire life avoiding unpleasant situations as much as humanly possible. It meant a lot of swallowing and smiling and apologizing for things she wasn't truly sorry for, and it meant never, ever starting conversations she didn't want to have. But if she didn't tell Andrew, the movie would come out, and there would be fake Lydia's face everywhere, and he would see it. She briefly considered suggesting that they go to Italy or somewhere for a year, just because. But things were probably too universal now, anyway. His email inbox would light up like the 4th of July, no matter where they were.
Sure,
Andrew said. He patted the cushion next to him. He was wearing an old T-shirt that had little scalloped holes around the neckline, one that he'd had almost as long as he'd had her. Instead of sitting beside him, Elizabeth leaned against the porch banister.
You know that movie about Lydia?
Yeah,
Andrew said, already wary.
They're doing it, I said yes.
Elizabeth watched Andrew's jaw clench.
But I never said yes, he said.
His eyes narrowed. Sometimes Andrew reminded Elizabeth of a cat, the way cats' other secret eyelid closed when they were asleep. With Andrew, the secret eyelid closed when he was angry.
They wanted me to sign the form, and I never did.
I know that, Elizabeth said. It was semantics, she knew, but it was all she had, a technicality. But the lyrics are mine, and I let them have it. I was the manager. I agreed on your behalf.
What exactly does that mean, you agreed on my behalf?
It means... Elizabeth paused, considering how best to get the words out of her mouth. It means that I signed your form. I signed your name.
Andrew shook his head. Meaning that you forged my signature? Are you fucking kidding?
He stood up and dusted off his jeans.
This isn't a credit card receipt at a restaurant, Lizzie. This is actually serious. I can't believe he did that. It's going to be total garbage, you know that. Garbage that doesn't even tell the whole story.
You're worried about Lydia? Elizabeth waved to a neighbor across the street, offering a tight smile.
I'm worried about you, Lizzie, not Lydia. At least Lydia was always upfront about what she wanted. She might have been kind of an asshole, but at least she didn't pretend to be something else. Everyone else thinks you're so sweet, so nice.
Andrew rolled his eyes and pulled his phone out of his pocket.
I have to go.
Time for another yoga class?
Elizabeth rolled her eyes back at him. It was involuntary, a contest to see who could devolve the fastest.
You have never understood me, Andrew said. And obviously, if this is something that you are capable of, I have never understood you.
Elizabeth crossed her arms and cocked her head to the side.
That is a crazy thing to say. Crazier than saying yes to something like that without talking to me?
She hated it that he made sense.
Harry's going to see that movie, and he's going to think he understands us better, you know? And what is he going to understand? He's going to think that the version of Lydia on the screen is what she was really like. And what are the odds of that happening? It's going to be about Lydia the martyr, which is the most bullshit thing ever. Do you remember the last time we saw her?
Andrew turned around so that they were both facing the house, with their backs to the street. Elizabeth remembered. They were at Veselka in the East Village, having an early dinner of pierogies and applesauce. Harry was 6 months old, asleep in the car seat, which sat on the floor between them. He loved ambient noise, people talking, forks clinking, and so they brought him everywhere. The rules about celebrities were clear. You were not supposed to notice, and if you did, you were honor-bound to ignore whoever it was. There was a ripple in the room, a game of telephone. Whispers bounced off the walls and the ceiling. Elizabeth, sleep-starved and leaking milk, scooted as far to the right as she could and looked toward the front of the restaurant. The crowd parted like the Red Sea into two distinct human walls 3 feet apart. The only people who didn't care about Lydia were the Polish waitresses. Everyone else stood still, eyes wide. Elizabeth waved, but Lydia didn't see her, so focused on making her way across the room.
What's going on?
Andrew said, swiveling around in his chair.
Oh.
She was nearly abreast of their table. The room had quieted to a hush. Andrew cleared his throat, which he always did when he was nervous. Why was he nervous? She was their friend. She had been their friend.
Lydia!
Elizabeth said. She pushed her chair back and stood up. All around them, diners in pseudo-punk garb looked on, appalled at the breach of conduct. They'd already horrified everyone by bringing the baby, but this was a whole new level of misbehavior. Lydia's eyes were swimming, murky and red. She turned slowly toward the sound of her own name, clearly half meaning to ignore it the way she probably did most of the time. Her eyes finally settled on Elizabeth, standing, and on Andrew, still sitting across the table, his fork in hand with the pierogi speared on top. Lydia smiled and spread her arms open wide, bypassing Elizabeth and going straight for Andrew, who hugged her awkwardly with his fork still in hand. The punky kids at the table next door were trying not to turn into girls at a Beatles concert and doing a terrible job. Lydia either didn't notice them or managed to ignore them entirely without seeming rude. There was a force field of fame around her, thick as Pyrex. She stroked Andrew's face with her thumb.
How are you?
Lydia cooed. She turned her gaze toward Elizabeth.
Your cheeks look different.
I just had a baby, Elizabeth said. We just had a baby.
Readers,
Lydia said, and laughed. Her entourage laughed, too. She patted Andrew on the chest.
Look at you, Daddy.
Congratulations on the warehouse movie, Andrew said. Or is it about a factory? We haven't seen it yet, but I hear it's great.
Lydia shrugged.
They tell me it's good, she said. But they tell me everything's good, so.
Under the table, Harry began to cry, little hiccuping bursts of sound. Elizabeth bent down to pick him up and quickly jostled him sideways until he latched onto her breast. She was still standing in the middle of the restaurant, and everyone was looking at her. At Lydia, and now at the pink cushion of her nipple, which slipped in and out of Harry's mouth as he fussed.
God, he's like a cannibal, Lydia said, and pretended to gnaw on her own hand.
That is so scary.
She kissed the air.
Good to see you, she said, looking at Andrew. She made a loud munching noise at Elizabeth and turned away.
A waiter pointed her and her friends to a table in the far back corner, and once she was sitting, the noise in the restaurant rose up and swallowed them. Elizabeth sat down again and found herself blinking back tears.
What's the matter? Andrew said.
Nothing, Elizabeth said. Let's just go. When he's done, let's just go.
She looked down at Harry's sweet face, sucking away. A year and a half later, Lydia was dead.
I'm sorry, Elizabeth said. It had all been a mistake.
She couldn't even blame Naomi for talking her into it. Elizabeth could see herself nodding along at the idea, so eager to sign on the dotted line. It was like an O. Henry story, only she'd sabotaged herself. She had been her own sacrifice.
It was for you, she said, knowing that he wouldn't see it that way. I did it for you.
Did you? Andrew said. The door is unlocked. I'll be back later. And just so you know, what I'm doing over there isn't just yoga. It's self-care. I'm not pretending that it's a present for you. You should try it sometime.
He slipped his feet into his sandals and flopped down the stairs and onto the sidewalk. Chapter 42. The Waves was going to be gorgeous. It would help revitalize the Rockaway community. It would be an emissary of deep Brooklyn values. It would be less expensive to renovate than a hotel in Manhattan. It turned out that Dave had been planning it for a while. It was all part of the evolvement plan. Dave had taken a couple of meetings with architects, some evolvement yoga practitioners who lived in the neighborhood, just to get a sense of time and money. Now he wanted Andrew to come along. He really got it, Dave said. They were meeting at one of the coffee shops on Cortelyou, a few doors past Hyacinth. Dave and Andrew walked down from evolvement.
I hear that place is good, Dave said. It is. The couple who owns it are our good friends, Andrew said. Should we meet there instead?
Dave stopped.
No,
Andrew said, and kept walking. They were in front of the cafe, and Dave waved to a guy sitting in the window. He held up a finger, 1 minute, and then turned so that his back was facing their date.
I've been meaning to ask you this, Dave said, and there's no really good way. I don't want you to feel awkward or like there's any pressure coming from me. You know that I am all about comfort and good vibes, and if this is not your thing, man, that is cool. But I think it might be your thing.
Andrew squinted into the sunlight.
Uh-huh,
he said.
I want to bring you on as an investor for the Waves. I think that it would be a really amazing project for us to do together. What do you think? Do you want to be partners?
How much are we talking? I mean, in terms of money, how much? Andrew could see it so easily, himself as a hotelier, picking lamps and records for the guest rooms. Talking to reporters at the New York Times about giving back to Brooklyn, about introducing people to places beyond the bridge, beyond Williamsburg.
It's hard to say, Dave said. We could probably get the whole thing going for under $1 million, give or take. The place is on the market for $700,000.
He ran his hand over his beard, giving the whole thing a squeeze.
There are other investors, of course, but they don't really see it, you know, which makes the whole thing way more of an uphill battle.
Of course, Andrew said.
It could be his new circuit. He could sit in the back during guided meditation classes and look over lists of vendors they needed to contact. He could write checks. He could make something new.
I'd love to, Andrew said. He put out his hand, but Dave dove into his body for a hug instead, giggling. Chapter 43. Elizabeth was forgetting things everywhere. She forgot her dressy shoes at the office. She forgot the keys to her listings at home. She texted Zoe to make a dinner date but hadn't heard back. She and Andrew weren't talking, and she reluctantly understood why.
even though he was obviously the one acting like a crazy person. Signing his name on one piece of paper wasn't betrayal. Still, she understood. Marriage was supposed to be a sacred covenant, and if that wasn't quite achievable on a daily basis, marriage was about always getting the okay from the other person before doing something major. Want to go bungee jumping or switch health insurance policies? Want to pierce the kid's ear? Want to buy a new sofa, book airline tickets to France? You had to confer. It wasn't the same as asking permission, nothing so archaic. It was about being on the team, being equal partners. She wanted to blame the fact that she'd said yes on being the kind of woman who wanted to be accommodating to everyone, but that was only part of it. The other, larger reason was that she really did want to see the movie. Elizabeth imagined seeing it by herself in the middle of the afternoon and weeping into a bucket of popcorn. That was what she wanted, to celebrate and mourn her youth simultaneously. Elizabeth wanted to take some photos of Zoe's house, mostly for her own reference. They still hadn't pulled the trigger, and maybe they never would, but she wanted to take a few pictures for herself. The house had never belonged to her, of course, but Lydia had never belonged to her either, and they both had helped to build whatever it was that made up Elizabeth's life. She wanted to walk around the house without Zoe, for the first time in 100 years with no actual purpose. Not because she'd agreed to walk bingo or to watch Ruby or to bring in the mail. She just wanted to think about the house and about Andrew. It was easy enough to convince herself that it was a business visit. No matter how well you knew a house, pictures were important. And that way, eventually, she could talk to Deirdre about the list price, just to get a second opinion. Zoe hadn't said anything about moving forward lately. In fact, she'd been a little hard to pin down. But she didn't hesitate to give her blessing for Elizabeth to pop over and poke around. It was all a part of her figuring out what she wanted to do. That's how Elizabeth saw it. She didn't want to feel like an angel of death, hovering over her friend's marriage. She was just trying to be helpful. If Jane and Zoe could split up, it could happen to anyone. They'd always been stable and happy enough, happy as anybody. Sure, Zoe sometimes complained about Jane, but no more than Elizabeth complained about Andrew. Having someone close to you decide to quit, or even seriously consider it, was axis knocking. Why them? Elizabeth found herself wondering. Why now? Zoe didn't seem clear herself, which was the scariest part. Elizabeth had always had keys to the Bennets, the con Bennets. Would Zoe go back to being just plain Bennet? There were so many things to worry about, enormous and tiny. It was too much to bear. Elizabeth jogged up the steps and unlocked the door. Zoe had told her that they'd all be out. She and Jane doing some restaurant thing, and Ruby at Hyacinth. Bingo was asleep on the living room floor and raised his head and offered a genial sniff. It was always better to be in someone's house without them. That's when you could really look at the cracks in the ceiling, the sticky cabinets, the floors of the closets. No one wanted to spend that much money for someone else's dirt. If Zoe really went through with it, with the breakup, with the sale, these things were separate and they were together kissing cousins, Elizabeth would have to bring in a real cleaning crew at least twice, once for the official photos and once for the first open house. She knew 2 Salvadoran women who could make any house look like the Vatican. She'd have Zoe call them for sure if the house actually did go on the market. Mostly, it looked the same as it had 100 years ago, when she and Andrew had shared the house with Zoe and the other guys from Oberlin. Elizabeth closed her eyes and could see the Indian print tapestries that had hung on the walls, the full ashtrays on the coffee table. Disco money paid for the house, and there had been traces of it in various spots. Records everywhere, some framed on the walls, old hilarious photos of Zoe's parents with giant afros and glittering jumpsuits. Those were gone now, replaced with pictures of Ruby as a baby, and the elder Bennets appeared in their civilian clothes. Elizabeth snapped the kitchen, which had the best stove in Ditmas Park. People wouldn't understand how much it cost by looking at it. She'd have to explain in the listing. The living room and its endless piles of magazines, the dining room and its endless supply of chairs. She photographed the staircase from below and the pretty sconces that were original to the house. On the second floor, she flipped on the light switch in the hallway and took pictures in the bathroom. She paused outside Ruby's room, which Elizabeth had once shared with Andrew. That was the first time she ever really felt like they were a couple, like they were adults who had chosen to be together. He was so good at everything then, so good at building them shelves out of bricks and boards, so good at kissing her shoulders before they went to sleep. He liked showing her his city, the good parts and the bad parts, the the museums and the parts of Central Park he had explored alone as a teenager. His hair was still long, and he would tuck it back behind his ears over and over again, a nervous tick, as they sat across from each other in bed, eating takeout Chinese food. He made her laugh. He danced. Elizabeth turned the knob to Ruby's room and opened the door, flicking the light on.
"Mom, Jesus, not much,"
Ruby said. Elizabeth saw a flash of a bare breast. There was some scrambling.
"Oh, I'm so sorry, sweetie. It's Elizabeth. Your mom said that no one would be home,"
Elizabeth said, covering her eyes with her hand. "Wait a second," she said, and slid her hand back down. "Hi, Mom," Harry said, and pulled the sheet up to his chin. He and Ruby were sitting side by side, all red cheeks and knotty hair sticking up at odd angles. The room smelled like sweat and dirty clothes and other identifiable things that Elizabeth refused to let herself name.
"Harry,"
Elizabeth said,
"what are you doing here?"
She covered her eyes again.
"Can you please get dressed?"
There was more scrambling. Elizabeth heard the sound of a belt buckle and couldn't help herself from groaning.
"Okay, it's fine,"
Harry said a minute later, sitting on the edge of the bed. Ruby had pulled on a dress and piled her hair on top of her head with a giant clip, the braids from the concert already gone. Harry looked so old, too old. He looked like his father, and Elizabeth felt her nose start to run, which always happened right before she burst into tears.
"Shit, Mom, I'm sorry. It's a messed up situation, I guess, but it's really not that bad. We're using, protection and everything, I swear."
Elizabeth blinked quickly. She felt a bit faint, as if she'd just inhaled a can of paint thinner.
"Do you mind if I sit down, Ruby?"
She looked around and saw the telltale lump of a beanbag chair underneath a small mountain of clothing. Ruby pointed and nodded. Harry's cheek seemed to indicate that he would rather his mother leave the room where he had, until very recently, been naked with a girl, but he wasn't going to say that.
"Okay,"
Elizabeth said.
"So, here we are."
"Want a glass of water?" Ruby said. She crawled to the edge of the bed like a puppy, her cleavage amply visible.
"Sure,"
Elizabeth said, turning her face toward the ceiling. Ruby padded out the door and down the stairs.
"Mom," Harry said, "I'm really sorry."
"Sorry about which part, love? Sorry about not staying away from Ruby, or sorry about growing up?"
Something was digging into her back. Elizabeth reached behind her, pulled out a chemistry textbook, and tossed it onto the floor. Ruby pushed the door back open with her elbow and handed glasses of water to both Elizabeth and Harry.
"Let's just be real about all this, okay?"
She looked to Harry, who simultaneously nodded and curled his lip, no doubt as afraid of what Ruby was about to say as Elizabeth was.
"Harry and I are not trying to be sneaky assholes, Elizabeth. We just like spending time together. It is totally my fault that we got in trouble, but it's also totally his fault, and that's okay."
"I know," said Elizabeth. "I don't care anymore."
"What?"
said Harry.
"I don't care that you two are an item. I'm sure no one says that anymore. I don't care that you're hooking up, or on lock, or on the down low. It's fine with me. It's healthy. It's just also really sad, for reasons I can't quite put into words."
She looked at Harry.
"You're my baby. I just want to know that you're safe, and that nothing bad is going to happen to you."
"Mom, I'm 17.
He was blushing.
"Then you'll be my baby when you're 35, and when you're 50.
She was sweating.
"I think I'm having a hot flash. Is that possible?"
Ruby and Harry both looked uncomfortable.
"Listen," Elizabeth said. "I'm not going to tell your father, Harry, or your mother's, Ruby, but you two have to promise me something."
She was hot and tired. She felt like she was 100 years old, like a wrinkled old crone in a fairy tale.
"Anything," Harry said.
"Depends," Ruby said. "Help me figure out what your father is doing and how to get him out of there. You'll be my little Nancy Drew and Hardy boy. Will you?"
Harry looked startled at her request, but Elizabeth kept talking.
"I just need a little help. Can you two give me a little help?"
They nodded, solemn-faced. Elizabeth gulped down her sweating glass of water.
"I'll put this in the sink on my way out. And clean your room, Ruby. It looks like a deranged hobo is squatting in here, okay?"
Ruby said.
"See you at home, Harry,"
Elizabeth said. She pushed herself up to stand and walked slowly into the hallway. She pulled the door shut behind her and waited for a minute to make sure there was no laughter. When she was satisfied, Elizabeth stepped gingerly down the stairs and back out onto the street, her head up high, as if she were walking on a balance beam.
Chapter 44. Zoe had texted Jane late that afternoon. Dinner tonight? Chinese? Sunset Park? It was what they used to do when they wanted to talk business over a meal. They couldn't go anywhere in the neighborhood because they knew every single person who owned every single restaurant. There were only half a dozen, after all. And eventually, whoever it was would come over and sit with them, and they'd all be talking about purveyors and farms and about which servers had drug problems. Jane texted back, "Pick me up at 8. And at 8 o'clock on the dot, she was standing in front of Hyacinth, hands in her pockets, waiting for Zoe to appear at the corner and then pull up in front. The car appeared at 8:03 p.m. Not bad for her wife. Jane still loved saying wife. If that was the Long Island in her, so be it. She had no interest in being transgressive. She loved living in the only neighborhood in New York City that felt like the suburbs, and she loved living there with her wife and her kid and her garage and her walk-in pantry. Zoe slowed to a stop, the windows rolled down. Jane got into the car and buckled her seatbelt.
"Hey," she said.
"Hiya," said Zoe. She was wearing a dress that Jane liked, a blue swirly thing that tied around her waist. "How are you?" They'd spent the day talking about vegetables and orders and menus, but that wasn't what she meant.
"Not bad. This is a nice surprise."
Jane rubbed her hands on her knees. "Yeah, well, I was in the mood for Chinese food."
"Sounds great."
Jane crossed her arms over her chest, then shifted back to her hands on her knees.
"Relax," Zoe said. She reached over and cupped her hand over Jane's. "It's just dinner." "If it were just dinner, we'd be at home."
Jane fiddled with the door lock. They turned up Coney Island Avenue.
"Fine, it's a date," Zoe said. "Happy?"
Jane let out a little snort.
"If you must know, yes."
She slid her phone out of her pocket and plugged it into the car stereo. The night had cooled down, and the air that blew in through the car's open windows was brisk enough to give her tiny goosebumps on her forearms. Jane scrolled through her music until she found just the right song, and then turned up the volume. Zoe's parents' biggest hit of 1978, "My Baby Wants to Boogie Tonight," blasted through the speakers, and Zoe laughed. They were having a good time already. Chapter 45. Ruby spent her evenings at Hyacinth pondering the future. It was a slow night, with only a few tables lingering over dessert in the garden. It was almost 10. Neither of her mothers had been around, which was nice, because it meant she could be terrible and lazy at her job. It was a cool night for the end of July, and she wished she'd brought a sweater. She stole Jorge's hoodie from behind the bar and put it on, knowing that he wouldn't mind. It didn't exactly look professional, but it was deep Brooklyn on a Wednesday night, and so who really cared? The way Ruby saw it, she had a few different choices. She could stay at home and apply for school again in a year. She could go on one of those intense, semi-abusive programs where you hike through the desert for 3 months with no toilet paper. She could move to New Orleans and shuck oysters for tourists. At this point, she could do any of it. It was just a matter of deciding what she wanted. Harry would be in Brooklyn for another year, which was something, but not if they couldn't be seen together without his parents losing their minds. Ruby wandered over to the door and pressed her nose to the glass. Her pocket buzzed. She pulled out her phone. "Party at Nico House when you're done working." Dust had no plan, and he seemed fine with it. When they were dating, he had told Ruby that he never wanted to have a job that paid him more than $15 an hour, and that he never wanted to work more than 10 hours a week. His only jobs had been at a skate shop and at a skate park, neither of which he'd done for more than a few months, and so he seemed to be doing a pretty good job of accomplishing his goals thus far. If Ruby went into the garden to re-clean already clean tables, which she sometimes did to try to hurry along customers, she might have been able to hear the party. Nico's house was only a quarter of the block down, and when it was nice outside and people were in the yard, voices carried. Tonight, though, she wasn't interested. She'd seen Sarah Dinnerstein traipsing down the street earlier that afternoon, wearing shorts that even Ruby would have thought twice about, and she really didn't need to see how a few hours of sun and booze had added to the effect. One of the couples from the back was chatting behind her, drunk on mediocre wine. "Sorry," they said, squeezing past Ruby to get out the door.
"Come back soon,"
she said, as monotone as possible. By the time she walked back to her post, the other couple was finally paying, and after a few long, wet kisses, up on their feet and walking to the door.
The server on duty, a tall guy named Leon, rolled his eyes at Ruby as he ran their credit card.
Let's get the fuck out of here, he said. No offense.
None remotely taken, Ruby said. She organized the menus and started piling the chairs on the tables, and Leon grabbed the broom. They got the garden cleaned up, as they'd already done everything else. She could hear the party, or what sounded like it, and the whole garden smelled like weed, and Sarah Dinnerstein's Rastafarian essential oil perfume that she bought from a guy with a card table set up outside the Union Square subway station. Jorge and Leon closed the two registers while Ruby waited outside with the keys for the roll-down security gate. Once all three of them were outside, Ruby locked the padlocks. She would text Harry when she was closer, check and see if he was still awake. It was kind of cool that Elizabeth hadn't turned them in, but it was also weird and sort of freaky. Ruby's parents had always been relaxed, too relaxed, and she had always thought of Elizabeth as the good mom, the one who always knew where her kid was, and who had regular food in the fridge, and who knew all the best bedtime songs. Elizabeth was not supposed to be drinking a glass of water on Ruby's beanbag chair, her eyes all crazy. In the very back of the restaurant, something flickered, a firefly, probably. Ruby squinted through the gate. There was something red in the corner, along the wooden fence, but she couldn't quite see what it was. It was probably nothing. It was late, and Ruby was tired.
Okay, guys,
she said to Jorge and Leon, giving each of them a high five.
See you later.
They walked toward the corner together, but instead of turning left to go home, Ruby turned right and walked toward Nico's house. When she was a few car lengths away, she crossed the street and slowed down. There were a few people on the porch, but she couldn't tell who it was. The party seemed to have died down, at least out front. Ruby squatted down in between two cars and leaned against a bumper. She could see the porch and the little floating red dots of people's cigarettes in the air. Chloe had texted her that morning. Paris was in some other time zone, and Ruby had no idea if Chloe knew that she was writing at 6 a.m. or cared. It just said, "Hi, I miss you," with a long string of hearts. It was bullshit. Everything was bullshit. All of Ruby's friends were about to leave her forever. Who was actually friends with people from high school? Everyone loved to say that people who peaked in high school were stupid and lame, and didn't that mean that by holding on to those people, you were also stupid and lame? Wasn't everyone trying to trade up? Chloe would join a sorority and live in a house with a gaudy chandelier, and then she'd go to law school, and then she'd get married, and then she'd have three kids, and then she'd move to Connecticut, and then they'd see each other at their 20th Whitman reunion, and they'd hug and kiss and pretend that one of them was going to get on Metro North so they could see each other. Paloma was the same, but worse. She might be interesting. At least Dust and Nico were going to stay the same forever. It made Ruby feel less pathetic about her own life choices, or lack thereof. People on the porch were laughing. A few months ago, Ruby would have sauntered up the steps, pulling a cigarette out of someone's mouth and sticking it in her own, the queen of the goddamn place. Now what was she? She was a hostess. She recommended the crostini and the housemaid aioli for the French fries. Her boyfriend was a recent divergent who took practice SATs for fun. Ruby imagined crossing the street and getting run over by a truck. Ruby imagined crossing the street and having a giant gate come down right in front of Nico's front steps. She imagined her friends, her former friends, ignoring her while she walked through the house like she was invisible. Ruby imagined seeing Dust fucking Sarah Dinnerstein on Nico's invisible parents' bed. "This is so stupid," she said. Her knees hurt from pressing against somebody's bumper. She got up slowly, like an old lady, and stooped over to walk back down the block. The breeze was even smokier than before. It no longer smelled just like weed or patchouli or Marlboros. Now it truly smelled like fire. "What the shit?" Ruby said. When she got to the corner, there were a few people standing in front of Hyacinth, staring in the windows, all of them on their cell phones. She started to run. Part 3. Mistress of Myself. The queue at Cortelyou, Titmus Park's neighborhood blog. Posted at 11:37 p.m. Anyone else smell smoke? We've been out on the street for half an hour trying to trace the origins of the fire. Seems to be coming from the south. Reply in comments with any info. Chapter 46. Jane's phone rang, then Zoe's. Their phones were both sitting in the car's cup holders and between the front seats, but Jane and Zoe were in the back seat. Zoe's underwear was slung around one ankle, and Jane's right hand had vanished up her dress. They had bellies full of dumplings and mouths full of each other. The cloth seats in the Subaru had seen worse.
"Who the hell keeps calling?" Jane said into Zoe's neck.
It was probably Elizabeth, calling Zoe to ask her which side she should fall asleep on, which hand she should use to hold her toothbrush. She didn't care. Let the phone ring. Food was always the way back in. Why hadn't she thought of it? Jane liked fine dining as much as the next girl, but really she always wanted something salty and fried that could be eaten with chopsticks. Zoe's skin was as delicious as a bowlful of MSG, and Jane was trying to lick her from top to bottom, every inch she could reach without pulling a muscle. It had been a solid decade, if not more, since they'd fooled around in the back seat of a car. There was one long late-night cab ride from Union Square to Ditmas Park that Jane could remember, with at least 3 orgasms apiece, but man, it had been a long time. Her body pulsed, and so did Zoe's. They were breathing in unison, the air thick and shared.
"I just hope it's not the police again," said Zoe.
She laughed a little, but then paused. She scooted out of Jane's reach. Jane rolled back against the seat while Zoe squeezed through the front seats to grab her phone.
"It was Ruby," she said. "And Leon. Oh, my God."
Zoe reached down and stuck her other leg into her underwear and climbed into the front seat, giving Jane a glorious view, a single moment of pure pleasure, like looking at a Renoir in person.
"It's Hyacinth."
They double-parked in front, right behind the fire engine. The firehouse was only 2 blocks away, so they'd arrived fast. Ruby hadn't even called. She'd just run over and banged on the door until someone opened up. Ruby, Leon, and Jorge were still out front, the 3 of them sitting on a little silver bench 1 storefront away, taking turns popping up and smoking on the corner. Ruby had a cigarette in her mouth when her mother's got there, and Jane plucked it out and threw it on the ground.
"What happened?"
Ruby started to blubber, and Leon put his arm around her. Jane shook her head.
"God damn it, will someone tell me what is going on?"
She craned her neck to see past all the firemen into the restaurant. One of the firefighters came over, slow in his enormous suit.
"Ma'am, are you the owner?"
"Yes, we are,"
Jane said, pulling Zoe close.
"What happened?"
There was smoke in the air.
"It seems there was a fire in the backyard behind the restaurant, and it spread into your building. Luckily, your daughter was here before the fire had reached all the way through. There is heavy damage, but the building is salvageable. Come and see."
Jane and Zoe stepped gingerly through the open doorway. The glass had been shattered and covered the entrance, shards reaching nearly to the hostess stand. Inside, the smoke still felt thick, and the air smelled like a wet campfire. The floor, where it wasn't covered with broken glass, was slick with water from the sprinklers and the firefighters. Jane pulled the neck of her t-shirt up over her nose and mouth and held it there. There was a large black shadow printed all the way along the wall of the dining room. The ceiling was in pieces, flaking off like a sunburn, and the glass doors out to the garden were broken too. Jane clenched her fist, ready to hand someone, anyone else, the bill. But when she looked outside, she knew the answer. In any game of rock, paper, scissors, fire beat everything. The wooden tables in the garden were all ruined and would have to be replaced. The chairs were gone too. The back wall, a wooden fence, looked like it had been eaten by an angry shark.
"Shit," Jane said.
"Shit," Zoe said, coming up behind her. She rested a hand flat against Jane's back. The firefighter shrugged.
"At least it didn't get all the way inside. You're really lucky that your daughter was here. Another few minutes and the whole place would have been up, gone."
"Thank you," Jane said and shook the firefighter's hand. After he walked away, she turned to Zoe.
"Seems like we're really making the rounds lately, huh? What's next, the Coast Guard?"
"Don't even joke," Zoe said.
"How long before we can open again, you think?"
"A month? 2?
God, I don't know. Oh, man." The power was off. Everything in the walk-in would be ruined. There was gorgeous fish, beautiful marbled steaks, all those stupid tomatoes. Enough fresh mozzarella for 3 days of caprese salads. Everything would go to waste. She should take home what they could eat now while anything was still good, if anything was still good.
Shit.
She hadn't even checked the damage in the kitchen yet. That's where the sprinklers would have gone off first, no matter what. But Jane made a mental list of all her beautiful equipment, all her jars, all her fucking salt, everything.
"It's okay," Zoe said. "It's just money."
She pulled her phone out of her pocket and started taking photos.
Go check on Ruby. Jane made her way back to the street, glass crunching under her sneakers. Ruby had lit up another cigarette and was pacing back and forth in front of the health food store on the corner. She was wearing someone else's sweatshirt with the hood pulled tight around her face, her purple hair hanging out the sides like a psychedelic waterfall. Jane approached her slowly.
Mom, Ruby said. Her voice cracked. I'm so sorry. It was my fault. I should have caught it sooner. I thought I saw something when I was locking the gate.
Ruby's eyes were red. She took a long drag of her cigarette and bounced nervously on her toes.
I'm sorry that I'm smoking too, but I can't help it. Otherwise, I'm going to start pulling all my hair out.
Jane reached over and took the cigarette out of Ruby's hand. Instead of dropping it on the sidewalk, she put it to her own lips and took a drag.
Don't tell your mom.
Ruby exhaled loudly and fell into her mother's arms. Chapter 47. Elizabeth was groggy. She'd slept terribly, rolling around all night. Andrew had fallen asleep upon impact, as usual, and watching him sleep while they were fighting was 10 times worse than watching him sleep when they were getting along. The window was open, and at midnight some drunk person had been yelling on the sidewalk. At 3, a car alarm went off over and over. There were the usual sirens, backdrop to the city life, insistent and wailing. Elizabeth had finally fallen asleep around 4, she thought, but it was equally possible that she'd been awake until just before 6, and finally conked out for an hour, until Andrew woke her up with a cough. When she opened her eyes, he was standing on his side of the bed, looking at her. Her cell phone was in his hands.
What? She said. What is it?
Harry was sitting on the couch, hunched over a bowl of cereal. Elizabeth pulled her robe tight around her waist and sat down next to him.
Honey, she said. I just heard from Zoe. There was a fire at the restaurant last night. Everyone is fine, but I thought you should know.
I know, Harry said. Ruby texted me last night. Like, when the firemen were going in. She said they broke the door with axes, even though the fire wasn't even near the door.
He slurped up a spoonful of milk.
You knew? How could you not wake me up?
Elizabeth stretched her fingers toward Harry's neck and pretended to strangle him.
God, Harry!
What were you going to do, run down there with a bucket of water?
He raised the bowl in front of his face as a barrier when Elizabeth glared at him.
Sorry, I should have told you, fine.
I'm going to pop down there and see if they need anything. You stay here and out of trouble, okay? Harry waved goodbye with his spoon. The front door was open, and Elizabeth poked her head in, knocking on the doorframe. Zoe was sitting at the dining table, her phone to her ear, a stack of paper in front of her. Ruby and Jane were both in the kitchen with their backs to the door. The whole house smelled like pancakes and bacon.
Hey, Elizabeth said. Can I come in? I just heard.
Zoe glanced up and waved her in, but a look passed over her face that made Elizabeth stop just inside the door.
I can come back if now isn't good, she said, half whispering.
Zoe waved her in again, more vigorously.
I'm on hold, endless hold, she said. It's shocking, I know. Insurance companies are surprisingly hard to get on the telephone when a place burns down.
Jane muttered something, and Ruby laughed.
Oh, hi, Elizabeth,
Ruby said, swiveling around in a clumsy pirouette. She winked. Elizabeth scuttled over to Zoe and gave her a quick hug before gently lowering herself onto the next chair over.
I can't believe it, she said. Are you okay? Can I help?
Zoe raised a finger. Hang on, I think I have an actual person now. Hello? She said into the phone. Yes, hello. Hold on, thank you so much. She mouthed, sorry, and then covered her left ear with her hand and walked up the stairs. Jane set an enormous platter of pancakes, thick, fluffy, generously studded with blueberries, in front of Elizabeth.
Stay, she said. I always make too many.
Ruby threw herself into the chair opposite Elizabeth and forked 4 huge pancakes onto her plate.
Oh, I shouldn't impose, Elizabeth said.
The pancakes smelled like hyacinth on a Sunday morning. Her stomach growled.
Really?
Jane said.
You know Zoe never eats more than 2.
Better you than Bingo. She smiled and handed Elizabeth a plate.
Okay,
Elizabeth said. For someone whose restaurant had just been knocked out of commission for an unknown period of time, Jane seemed remarkably upbeat.
Elizabeth edged off a small bite of pancake with the side of her fork.
Oh, my God, she said. These are insane.
I know, Jane said, and smiled even more broadly, like the cat who had eaten not only the canary but the nest, too.
No hard feelings about the other night, right?
Sure, Elizabeth said. Of course not.
I forgot the syrup, Jane said. What are we even doing?
She hustled back over to the kitchen and came back brandishing an oversized bottle of syrup. Jane poured giant puddles onto everyone's plate.
You are extra goofy today, Mom. Is there Prozac in these? Ruby said.
Ha ha, said Jane.
Maybe.
She stuck a quarter of a pancake into her mouth.
Tastes good, doesn't it? Nice and medicinal.
Ruby rolled her eyes, but was looking at her mother with affection. Elizabeth was tempted to back away slowly and open the door again, just in case she'd accidentally walked into an alternate universe. Zoe thumped back down the stairs, as quick on her feet as Ruby.
Hey, she said. Sorry about that. I think we have a good guy over there, Jane. Shouldn't be too bad. I mean, it'll be terrible, and God knows how long it'll take us to fix everything. But we're covered, and they know it, so at least all we're losing is time and money, you know?
Right, said Jane.
Great. You hungry?
Always, said Zoe. Instead of scooting behind Ruby, which would have been the most direct route to her chair, Zoe walked the long way around. Elizabeth pretended not to notice the way Zoe gave Jane's earlobe a gentle tug as she scooted behind her, and then she pretended not to hear the low little noise Jane made in response.
Did you make these with ricotta, or yogurt, or melted butter, or all three? Elizabeth said, instead of what she wanted to say.
When Zoe finally sat down again, Elizabeth widened her eyes and gave her a look, but Zoe only smiled, beatific and sweet and full of it. Chapter 48 The plans came together remarkably quickly. Dave was organized. Philip, the architect they met with at the coffee shop, drew a few different scenarios and priced things out, and then they were interviewing contractors, the three of them. Dave introduced Andrew as his right hand, his partner, and every time he said it, Andrew felt better about the whole thing. Sure, it was a lot of money, but this was what money was for, investing in things you believed in. If it all went well, and the other investors came in the way Dave thought they would, they'd be in construction by the fall and then spend the winter working on the inside, decorating and programming and finishing. Next summer, the Waves would be up and running. He could see all the photos now, he and Dave leaning casually against a rustic wooden check-in counter. Hotelier! His mother would no doubt find the career a bit gauche, but Andrew liked the thought of it. Purposeful, with a sprinkling of glamour. It was a good plan. The first check wasn't huge, $100,000. Dave said that they could squeak by with 75 and that 150 would be ideal, and so Andrew thought an even 100 was a good place to start. He and Elizabeth had an accountant in the slope and an investment person in the city, but he handled only their retirement accounts and Harry's college fund. That's where all their savings went. The big money, Andrew's family money, was taken care of by a junior guy in the Marks family arsenal of suits. He and Elizabeth touched the money only in case of emergencies, when they had to replace something in the house or when they occasionally had to borrow from the fund to pay Harry's tuition. It was just sitting there, not an endless Scrooge McDuck-sized swimming pool, but a good-sized puddle of money. Andrew lay on his back at the far end of the evolvement studio. It was relaxation meditation co-practice time, which meant that Dave offered a guided meditation while Salome walked around, giving miniature head and shoulder adjustments and massaging everyone's forehead. Andrew didn't have to pay for classes anymore, Dave insisted. He was part of the team. Kitty's mustache was the only other team Andrew had ever been on. A marriage was a partnership, and a family was a team of sorts, but those didn't count, not really. The band had had meetings and practices and voted on things. There was no voting in a marriage. Everything always had to be a double compromise. Parenting was an absurd job, mundane and sublime in equal measure. And once Harry had learned to talk, walk, and use the toilet, Andrew and Elizabeth had largely split up their days so that each of them could have some time off. When you were in a band and you wanted time off, it meant that you were quitting, and who cared, really? There was always another mediocre bass player.
Imagine every breath you take is a white light, Dave said. And the light travels in through your nose, in through your sinuses, across your cheeks, and up into your head. Now imagine the light is a ball in the world's softest pinball machine.